This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
In all three cases, the serving president went past his due date.
That's J. Stephen Morrison, an African affairs expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, on the recent fall from power of three leaders in Southern Africa. Details coming up.
Also, mental health in Liberia is being brought to the forefront through programs and training supported by the Carter Center Foundation. And the World Health Organization says the death toll from an outbreak of Ebola in the DRC has risen to 19.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, mental health in Liberia is being brought to the forefront through programs and training supported by the Carter Center Foundation. The training of mental health clinicians is making a lasting impact in Liberia's communities. Dr. Janice Cooper is project lead for the Carter Center's mental health initiative in Liberia. She said the training of clinicians has provided enthusiasm for filling gaps in Liberia's emerging mental health system. The Carter Center was founded by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter to support health, housing, and peace projects around the world. Dr. Cooper has worked in child and adolescent mental health for many years and says it is personally fulfilling to have this type of health care provider in the workforce. In the first part of a series from Liberia on mental health, I spoke with Dr. Cooper in her Monrovia office about the impact of health care providers in Liberia's communities and asked her what she would like to see in the near future.
In terms of how far mid-levels can go in terms of treating and providing support, the biggest barrier for us is the psychiatry barrier, is that we continue to not have enough psychiatrists. But in terms of providing mental health services in the community and at health centers, I think we're doing well. I guess the biggest gap we have right now is we have a national referral hospital that is not a very good place for someone to end up. It's overcrowded, it's basically two wards, one male and one female, and the care is not as good as it can be. And so I think that's one of our biggest gaps now, because if someone can treat someone in the community and they can stay close to their home as possible, that's great. But there will be people that have psychotic breaks. Often the first psychotic episode would be one that someone has never anticipated experiencing, and they may be severely ill. And then working just at the facility, the health clinic or the health center is not enough. That person really needs to be at least on a short-term hospitalization as you do a complete workup to see what they need before they can discharge them into the community. So we have a mental health policy. It calls for creating what they call wellness units, which are these short-term hospitalizations, these small units within a health facility, whether it's a crisis or they haven't their first episode and they need hospitalization. They can be there, they can be stabilized. The family can be taught how to manage that person back in the community. And so I think that's the way that we will probably go, but the resources for all of those, we should have one in every county. We have 15 counties.
What would be an example of a treatment?
So we have two types of clinicians. Mm-hmm. So from 2011 to 2015, we trained what we call generalists. And they generally worked with both adults and kids, but mostly adults, because those are the ones that are screaming, right? Mm-hmm. They're psychotic, they have bipolar, they're screaming for attention. And so the work we've been doing now since 2015 has really been focused on developing this cadre of child and adolescent who can focus on prevention, promotion, early intervention, and then treatment if kids need it. Mm-hmm. So they see kids who have developmental delays and developmental disorders. And oftentimes the parents have no clue about how to deal with these children. And so they work with them on how to work with their children, how to ensure that the delays they have they can at least address those and not let those children get worse. How would they let them get worse? Well, if you don't really know how to take care of a child that has developmental delay, you will ignore that child, you will not speak to that child, you will not necessarily encourage that child. In some cases, they hit the children, they beat on them because the children are not doing as they wished them to do, not really comprehending that those children don't understand. And so many times those kids regress. And so one of the things they do is they work with the parents to say, first of all, this child is as much of a gift as any other child. You didn't do anything wrong. And that's a lot of processing of things that the culture says something different about. They also work with children that have different childhood mental health disorders. So it could be anything from children that have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. We have them just as much as they have in the US. Children, especially adolescents who may be depressed, adolescents and pre-adolescents who may have tried to kill themselves or hurt themselves or engage in self-harming behaviors. So there are a range of childhood, social, emotional, and developmental disorders that they work with the parents on.
That was Dr. Janice Cooper, project lead for the Carter Center's Mental Health Initiative in Liberia. She spoke with me during a visit to her office in Monrovia.
The World Health Organization says the death toll from an outbreak of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo has risen to 19 people. The organization says a total of 39 cases, including 3 healthcare workers, have been reported in the northwestern Equator province. Congo's Ministry of Health and WHO are tracing contacts of the victims and offering them an experimental Ebola vaccine. The WHO says the vaccine called RVSV-ZBOV has been tested in thousands of volunteers in Europe, Africa, and the United States, and was judged safe for humans. The virus, which causes a hemorrhagic fever, is spread by direct contact with the bodily fluids of an infected person or animal. On Sunday, a WHO delegation, including the agency's director, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, visited the town of Bikoro, the center of the current outbreak. They said the Congolese government has reacted quickly to the crisis, but expressed concern about Bikoro's proximity to the provincial capital, Mbandaka, a city of about 1 million people.
Three Southern African presidents were recently forced out for perceived health problems, corruption, incompetence, or all of the above. VOA's Luis Costa Ribas looks at their falls from grace and what it means for democracy in Southern Africa.
Angola's José Eduardo dos Santos was believed to be seriously ill. Zimbabwe's Robert Mugabe purportedly was preparing to hand over power to his wife. South Africa's Jacob Zuma was besieged by allegations of corruption. All three presidents were replaced, all in different ways and all for different reasons. The common thread, each was an internal matter handled from within by the ruling parties. J. Stephen Morrison, an African affairs expert, is senior vice president at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C.
In all three cases, the serving president went past his due date, exceeded his period of value and functionality and became a liability to the ruling party. And so the dominant ruling party took matters into its own hands in ushering the head of state out of power.
Mr. Dos Santos, who led Angola for 38 years, left office in September. Mr. Mugabe ruled Zimbabwe for 30 years until November. Mr. Zuma governed South Africa for 9 years before he was sacked in February. Jardo Moekalia, formerly with the Angolan opposition party UNITA, teaches international relations at the University of the Potomac in Washington.
They all either promoted or at least encouraged corruption in their governments. They all seem to thrive in chaotic environments to govern. And I think in one way or the other also they promoted nepotism and the cronyism. And of course, when you put all these things together, they lead to difficulties, not only in terms of the rights of the citizens, but also development, economic development programs.
Mr. Moyakalia says he hopes the presidential sackings will foster a Southern Africa renaissance. He notes that even though the three presidents were forced out by their own parties, the party officials were responding to wider pressures.
The way the system is established in South Africa, most of these changes could only happen within the ruling party. But you cannot ignore the impact of the society on the actions of certain members of that ruling party. The same thing in Angola. Yes, it happened within the ruling party, but again, there was certainly the influence of the image of the old president that was completely discredited. They read the mood of the society. So the changes are not just happening in the vacuum. They are connected to the changing mood in the countries.
Although there is some consensus over what caused the president's removal from office, Mr. Morrison says the three leaders' departures doesn't necessarily signal stronger democracies in the region. The new presidents need to prove themselves, he says.
They have to be judged in the reinstitution of democratic competitive elections. They have to be judged according to whether they restore rule of law and the respect of human rights and the respect of the judicial process to protect individuals. They have to be judged in terms of the investment, budgetary investment practices of the state. Do they actually begin to invest in services and infrastructure that bring broader benefits to the population?
It remains to be seen how far changes will go. For now, many in Angola, South Africa, and Zimbabwe seem to be buoyed by the promises of reform and improvement of their country's governing practices. Luis Costa Rivas, VOA, Boston.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580, and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Mental health in Liberia is being brought to the forefront through programs and training supported by the Carter Center Foundation. And the World Health Organization says the death toll from an outbreak of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo has risen to 19. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Technical talks from Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia over a disputed dam that Ethiopia is building on the Nile River have stalled. Egypt and Ethiopia are at odds over the construction of the Grand Renaissance Dam, a hydroelectric project that Cairo fears will reduce the water that runs to its fields via Sudan. Addis Ababa hopes the dam will make Ethiopia a hub for the electricity-hungry region and denies it will undermine Egypt's water resources. Rawiya Tawfik is an associate professor of political science at Cairo University. She explained to VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi why the two countries were not able to reach a compromise.
I think the problem is that looking at Egypt and Ethiopia, they're sticking to the main positions. So there is no change if we follow the 17 rounds of negotiations. There is little progress because each party is actually sticking to its position. So for Ethiopia, for instance, its main point is rejecting historical agreements and thus deciding not to acknowledge Egypt's current share of the Nile water, historical share of the Nile water. For Egypt, Egypt is sticking to the fact that its historical rights and acquired rights in the Nile Basin has to be respected, which is not at all accepted by Ethiopia, because Ethiopia is claiming that it was not party of any agreement in the past and is not committed to accepting this share.
So what kind of options do Egypt have to deal with water security challenge perceived as a result of the Ethiopian dam?
Egypt has already taken some measures in order to increase the efficiency of water use. Egypt is already recycling water in order to bridge the gap between supply and demand. And according to the new Egyptian water policy, there is, you know, more and more in that direction, in increasing the efficiency of using water in agriculture in particular, because agriculture is consuming more than 80% of Egypt's water quota, and also for domestic use. So imposing penalties, for instance, on the excessive use of water for domestic purposes is something that is totally new, and it's meant to introduce a new culture of increasing water efficiency at the domestic level.
Could a drastic change in water flowing from the Nile to Egypt introduce an Egyptian military action?
No, I think this is very unlikely. Egypt has invested in promoting its relations with all African countries in the last 4 or 5 years, and all the Egyptian officials, even at times of crisis in the negotiations, have confirmed that the military option is not actually on the table. But at the same time, we should not rule out the fact that this is actually a major source of tensions in the region through proxy wars and interventions and so on. So there has to be an interest from all powers to mediate in solving this problem.
Ethiopia argues that Egypt's share of water will not be decreased by the dam, but the filling of the dam is the real problem. Is that the case?
Ethiopia is saying that, there will not be significant harm to Egypt and Sudan, but the problem is, what does this significant harm mean? Ethiopia does not actually acknowledge this share of either Egypt or Sudan, because it was not part of the 1959 agreement. So, Ethiopia is very reluctant to sign any agreement that will actually commit it not to reduce water flow to Egypt. So I think it's more like a diplomatic rhetoric that Ethiopia is trying to use in order to attract international regional support to its dam project, rather than a real commitment that Ethiopia is ready to respect.
That was Rawiya Tawfik, an associate professor of political science at Cairo University. She was speaking with our colleague, Mohammed El-Shanawi.
In the Gambia, journalists and human rights activists welcomed the Supreme Court's ruling that declared criminal libel unconstitutional. Media freedom activists, however, say more work needs to be done to repeal some of these sedition laws, which could land journalists in jail for insulting the president. VOA's Pandera Mbai reports.
The Gambia Press Union, the country's main journalism body, filed a lawsuit against the government of former President Yahya Jammeh in 2014. The suit aimed to override 4 laws the union says hampered the freedom of the press: laws on sedition, criminal defamation, and publishing false news. The court last week ruled that criminal defamation and a ban on false publication on the internet are unconstitutional. Sehu Jammeh is an official of the Gambia Press Union.
As for the judgment yesterday, what the Supreme Court did was that they have declared, as we thought, unconstitutional criminal defamation, so which means that libel will now be civil, and they have also declared unconstitutional false publication on the internet, which is also quite good, because this is the toughest media law we have.
The Jammeh government passed the false publication law in 2013. Under the law, anyone found guilty for circulating or publishing false information on the internet faced 15 years in prison or a fine of $3 million, $64,000. The court, however, let stand some provisions of the sedition laws. For example, news relating to incitement of public dissatisfaction against the government or insulting the president still stands. Jammeh says his group is disappointed.
The Gambia risks not doing well in terms of the development of its democracy when it wants to keep laws such as sedition and false news. In the law book, no transition will happen without these laws being there. So as far as the GPU is concerned, all options are on the table, including asking for a review for the Supreme Court to review their decision.
Omar Ba is the executive director of the Refugee Dream Center, a U.S. aid organization for refugees. He was jailed and tortured for his work as a journalist in his native Gambia.
I think it is a major setback, even though there has been some positive aspects of the judgment. But the fact that the Supreme Court decided to retain a certain portion of the law, it affects the progress of our democracy in two ways. One, it still shows that journalists could be punished for the work they do. And two, it reminds the population of the legacy of the dictatorship.
The International Committee to Protect Journalists says the Supreme Court decision does not comply with the February 2018 ruling by the Court of Justice of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. That court directed Gambia to immediately repeal laws on libel, sedition, and false news. But says the government needs to act now.
What I think this government should be doing is to change those laws, completely squash them, so that the legacy of the dictatorship would not be memorialized, but also enact new laws that create the enabling environment for journalists to be able to do their work.
Some Gambian journalists have been forced into self-censorship due to the media laws. Under the sedition laws, cartoonists and journalists risk being jailed if they publish work deemed to be demeaning to the president. Demba Ali Jawa is Gambia's information minister. He says the remaining sedition laws were not designed to protect the current president.
I'm sure it is not for Adamu Barrow. This law has been in the books all along. It is not a question of favoring Adamu Barrow. The law has been there all along. It's a question of Supreme Court squashing certain aspects of the law and retaining certain aspects of the law. And maybe that part of the law which we have decided to retain, kind of from not criticizing the president on a daily basis, everybody is criticizing the president.
But Bar of the Refugee Dream Center disagrees.
I think the fact that certain portions of the law that could punish journalists for criticizing members of the government, including the president, is an indirect way of protecting the person of the president. I don't think anybody should be immune to criticism.
Information Minister Jao says the government has set up a committee to look into some of the current laws and that some may be repealed. For VOA Africa, this is Pande Rimbai reporting.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Justin Thwaites, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, friends. This is Sunday Shomari, host of Let's Talk. Join me Monday for another exciting edition of your show. Our topic next week will be family planning. Are men and boys well served by family planning programs? This is next Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOA Africa presents a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
It's difficult to recognize Ebola because the signs, sudden fever, diarrhea, vomiting, are shared by other diseases. It's quite difficult for anyone, except a healthcare worker, to say definitively, yes, it is Ebola, or no, it is not Ebola. So if you have sudden fever, diarrhea, or vomiting, and you have been in direct contact with someone who is sick, you should go to the health center, because no matter the cause, you can receive help there. And remember, with the right information and together with our healthcare workers, we can protect ourselves from Ebola.
That was a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, brought to you by VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
on the next Straight Talk Africa. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and former Prime Minister Raila Odinga have agreed to end their political animosity. A discussion on Kenyan politics on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.